everyone, and welcome to the CPR Podcast. My name is Mike Barrow, and tonight I'm sitting down with a good friend of the show, Mr. Jason McConnell, and we're going to be talking about waveform capnography and how it is absolutely 100% underutilized in the pre-hospital setting. So Jason, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, Mike, first and foremost, thanks for the invite here. As far as EMS goes, I started in 2004. I quickly learned that after getting certifications as a basic EMT and an advanced EMT and then proceeding on to my paramedic level certification, that the real education had just started at that point in time. I started doing education stuff for EMS sometime in the mid-2012 and pretty much proceeded since then. I'm ready to begin.
Awesome. So we're going to start off with kind of just a basic scenario. I think anybody that's been in EMS for any length of time, this will absolutely be a relatable scenario. It's the middle of the night, you get dispatched to a complaint of difficulty breathing. You've got a mid-70s female. You start kind of flipping through her meds. She's obviously tachypneic. She's probably, you know, low 90s, high 80s for SpO2. Sounds just completely diminished throughout. She's got a history of CHF. She's got a history of COPD. I mean, she's definitely got some other cardiac implications going on. Where do you start in addressing how you're going to start treating this patient, and how is NTIDAL effective in differentiating between treatment modalities?
Well, first of all, if you have the ability to use nasal NTIDAL, I think it's appropriate for almost every patient we encounter in EMS. But for the specific case that you listed here, of course you got to do the monitor and get oxygen supply, which you can do with the nasal NTIDAL piece. And I try to get that on as quick as possible to get me a baseline reading. One, I want to know what my numbers are and what the waveform is, but I want to know what changes while I'm getting some other things set up and ready to go. My concern would be differentiating between, is this a CHF exacerbation or is this going to be a COPD issue where there's some things on the truck that I can, medicine-wise, that I can give that are going to alleviate the issue. And we can do that very quickly within a matter of a few seconds with the actual nasal NTIDAL piece in place properly and with some education as how to interpret it as well.
So understanding that, you sat through your cardiology class, you sat through your respiratory classes as well, you understand that bronchospasm isn't the only thing that creates a little bit of expiratory wheeze here and there. You know, you definitely have to consider cardiac asthma when it comes to CHF exacerbation. So let's say you hear a little bit of expiratory wheeze and you're kind of debating back and forth of, you know, do I give this person a nebulizer treatment? Do I open them up? Do I expose them to possible even worsening their CHF exacerbation? You slap on the nasal capnography, trying to differentiate between the bronchoconstriction or if there's just excess fluid. Let's say there is bronchoconstriction. What are you going to see on your NTIDAL?
Okay, so the first thing you're going to see is you're going to see a constriction waveform, most generally noted as what they call a shark fin. And what that is indicating is the fact that the patient has no problem getting air into the lungs, but they have an uneven emptying of CO2 to try to get out of the lungs. So you're going to see a restriction on the NTIDAL waveform. At this point in time, the number associated with it is not as important as differentiating between is this COPD or is this CHF, or is this a consideration of both but with a primary indication of first COPD in this case.
Now that you've kind of differentiated between whether it's just CHF exacerbation or if it's bronchoconstriction that's going on, when it comes to the numerical ranges of your NTIDAL, what are you going to be looking for each?
Okay, so if this is a COPD patient, you've already confirmed that it's got the shark fin waveform. The patient is obviously in some difficulty breathing, looks very anxious, and you're getting a good representative on the actual monitor from the NTIDAL. The next thing you're going to figure out is the actual numerical value, and is it high or is it low? Generally speaking, somebody who has an acute onset of difficulty breathing has increased respiration rate. So therefore, they're going to blow off a significant amount of built-up CO2 originally, causing kind of a mismatch. You're going to have a shark fin waveform, but you're actually going to have a low numerical value with it. Say 25. When this progresses and the respiration rate decides to decrease, and the heart rate will then increase, which they will continue to build up CO2. The problem is that the patient's no longer expelling it at a higher rate. So what you're going to have now a high numerical value associated with the actual end tidal waveform that you're seeing. Something probably in the 60s will let you know that this is now a severe incident. They're going to need immediate treatment to relieve the actual constriction so they can continue to expel the additional CO2.
All right, now that, let's say you have somebody with massive COPD exacerbation, their end tidal is reading the 60-70 range, they have that shark fin waveform that's going on. Worst case scenario, you start sticking them on CPAP, you're nebulizing a treatment through your CPAP, and you think that they're starting to do a little bit better. What are some things on the waveform that you're going to be looking for that's showing you if your treatment is actually helping your patient or not?
Okay. So the first thing you'll notice pretty quickly on the waveform, whether the shark fin, the rounded expiratory phase of this will start to square off, indicating that they're emptying a lot of CO2 relatively easy, which will give you your square form, indicating that the actual restriction or the severity of the restriction is starting to decrease, and you can trend that pretty quickly within a couple breaths. And also looking at the patient, their heart rate's generally going to come down, they're going to start to feel a little bit better, they're going to start to have less anxiety. What I would caution you is not to base your treatment off of pulse ox readings, because unfortunately pulse ox is so far in the past that we're trying to treat this patient currently right now in the present time. And if you want present indications for what's going on, you need to use end tidal.
Kind of switching topics a little bit. We've addressed the CHF versus COPD differentiation. What about trauma patients?
Well, this is probably the second most underutilized section with end tidal ability. You have the ability to do some really fascinating things with end tidal as far as effectively monitoring your treatment that you're currently giving them. So something as simple as fluid resuscitation. If your initial end tidal numbers are in the 30s, let's say you have a normal waveform, you have a severe trauma patient and has poor perfusion, and you start giving fluid boluses, what you should expect to see is an increase in end tidal numbers because you're increasing circulatory volume. So right there, it's a diagnostic tool. It'll tell you absolutely without a question that your fluid resuscitation has been beneficial towards the patient. Moving on to something like a needle decompression, again, kind of along the lines of the same thing, is you're going to have lower volume or lower end tidal numbers because you're using less lung room. You're using essentially one lung to ventilate and give you your numbers. So when you decompress the other side and you get full lung expansion, you have the ability to then expel greater numbers of CO2. So you'll have an increase in your CO2 number, confirming that your needle decompression was in fact beneficial and it did exactly what you were trying to do.
What about our head injury patients? I know for the longest time it was taught in the classroom that that patients with head injuries need to be hyperventilated. Where do we draw the line of what proper ventilatory management of our head injury patients are, and what are we doing to our head injury patients when we hyperventilate them?
So current guidelines are, as far as end tidal monitoring, you want to try to establish end tidal values between 30 and 35 for the known head injuries. And the reason for that is we have to decrease swelling of the brain, which is causing decrease of actual perfusion of the brain. But the tricky side of this is if you hyperventilate, what ends up happening is you decrease your CO2 level to the point where you end up with vasoconstriction metabolically in the head, so then therefore you decrease the perfusion of the brain. So it's a real slippery slope. We're not basing this on pulse ox numbers. We're not basing this on a randomly selected number that you read in a textbook. What we're saying is that if you monitor end tidal and you stay between your 35 and your 45, you will be perfusing the brain at the best scenario that you can, and yet also staying away from the hyperventilation, which is going to be more detrimental to your patient than slightly underventilating the patient.
On a far less technical aspect of that, I think all of us have been in situations where we think we're ventilating somebody on a pretty regular basis, or we're not ventilating too quickly, we're not ventilating too slow, But I think we fail to understand the effect that stress has on our bodies to continually hyperventilate people subconsciously. And on a side note, I think that NTidal is probably one of the best tools we have to actually make sure we're not hyperventilating somebody, even if we're trying to count it out in our head or do anything like that. It gives you, in the moment, stats of how you're ventilating your patients.
Alrighty, changing topics once again. Anaphylactic patients, I mean, obviously there are several different components of NTidal monitoring that you need to be doing on these patients, whether it's your cardiac output, like in your trauma patients, or if it's in your bronchoconstriction, like your COPD patients. This is a very sick patient that needs special consideration on several different levels. So what are you going to be looking for in these patients?
So when you apply your nasal NTidal device here, what you're going to see is you're going to see somewhat of a constriction due to the actual swelling of the airway from the allergic reaction. And what you need to pay attention to is the actual numerical value associated with it. If we're still in a low to medium 30 to 45-ish numbers, you have an allergic reaction that's not causing significant airway obstruction yet. These are the patients that you have time to put on a non-rebreather. You have time to try to talk some sense into them, try to talk them down from hyperventilating, and you can use your bronchotherapy medications you carry on the truck. The issue comes into play is when is severe enough to take action as far as using like IM epi. And what you'll notice is that you're going to have that constriction waveform, and you're going to have a high NTidal reading, which tells you that this patient is not effectively eliminating CO2 and is building up at a rapid rate. Their heart rate's going to be climbing, their respiratory drive is starting to diminish. These patients need IM epi, and they need it fairly quickly. You can set up your oxygen, you can set up your bronchotherapy dilation stuff for post-IM injection, but these patients need rapid IM injection to take care of the acute onset of this actual allergic reaction.
At the expense of opening a can of worms that I am definitely afraid to and pissing a lot of people off, I know that I think you and I share some similar opinions on how everyone has kind of jumped on the Narcan bandwagon for opiate overdoses and potentially using too much or using it a little too early when it comes to respiratory depression and having kind of a subjective viewpoint of whether or not someone needs Narcan. So when you're assessing a patient that you suspect of an opiate overdose, you slap on the nasal capnography. What is going to be an indicator for you to say, yeah, this guy needs a little bit of ventilatory support. Yeah, this guy's probably not oxygenating the way we want him to.
The problem that I see is that we're monitoring these patients based on an arbitrary number that a textbook gives us as far as whether the patient is ventilating themselves appropriate or not. The inability to measure NTidal at that level is the number one issue. Case in point, if you have somebody who's breathing four times a minute on a suspected opiate overdose, and you put nasal NTidal on them and your reading is, let's say, 39. I know that this patient's breathing only four times a minute. However, they are oxygenating themselves properly because they're not producing high NTidal volumes. So this patient would require just some mild oxygen therapy with the non-rebreather, positioning, make sure that you don't occlude the airway, and continue to monitor your NTidal values to make sure that nothing changes there. I, for one, do not thrilled about waking up an individual in the back of a moving vehicle that may become agitated and start a whole nother issue. If you have the ability to measure NTidals, and you need to formulate your ventilatory support with your NTidal numbers, meaning that you need to stay within 35 to 45. And the reason for that is if you start to hyperventilate an individual, the problem that you start to show is that on a metabolic level, you decrease the CO2 that you have in the circulatory body, which causes a left-sided shift in the oxyhemoglobin curve. And what that does is it does not allow the hemoglobin and the oxygen that are bound together does not allow them to unbind. So what you're going to have is you're going to have a pulse ox reading that's going to show 100%. However, that 100% circulation of O2 that's bound to the hemoglobin cannot unbind, so the body cannot use it. On the reverse side of that, if we hypoventilate somebody, you're going to have an increase in CO2 numbers, which is going to result in a right-sided oxyhemoglobin shift. And what this will show is when the pulse ox does finally catch up to us 10 to 15 minutes down the line, it's going to show a decrease in CO2 because there is no oxygen bound to the hemoglobin because of the right-sided shift.
Obviously, we do not endorse you guys straying away from your local protocols. I mean, obviously, if there's a set regulation of when to use your Narcan and the amount to use with a patient that you believe has some element of opiate overdose on board, we're not telling you to divert from that. There needs to be a common sense approach to Narcan. Obviously, if your patient is Smurf Blue, they need some ventilatory support. They're not oxygenating. They definitely need a little bit of help there. But I think the overuse of Narcan is going to eventually end up getting somebody hurt, whether it's the patient or the provider. That's a whole other topic for another day. So we're going to kind of just leave that one there for now. But one of the last things that we wanted to address when it comes to end-tidal monitoring is the septic patient. There's a huge push in the pre-hospital community right now to recognize and treat sepsis a lot more aggressively than we have in the past. Obviously, you have the inclusion of your SEERS criteria when it comes to pre-hospital recognition of sepsis. Whether it's your tachycardia is over 90, your tachypnea is over 20, a temp of greater than 101, or I believe less than 95. Where does end-tidal kind of play into all of this?
Well, first, we're not necessarily treating the sepsis. We're trying to identify it quickly and prevent the increased mortality rate that's happening with these patients. And the cool thing about end-tidal is if you can get a positive end-tidal reading, you got a good waveform and you got a number, what the studies are showing is if you have an end-tidal number that is less than 25 with an additional two criteria from the SIRS criteria, which is a systemic inflammatory response syndrome, if you have two positive findings in that of those four criteria and a end-tidal volume of less than 25, it's a high indication that this patient is a sepsis patient. We need to do aggressive treatment for this patient. And not only aggressive treatment, but you need to let the facility that you're going to, let them know that, hey, I have a pretty reasonable idea that this patient has sepsis. This is my current treatment. This is what I'm doing to try to get a step up in the right direction for the facility you're going to. And then be persistent once you get there. You know, I'm very positive with everything that I've seen with the criteria that's been met that this patient is a sepsis patient and needs further help.
Going back to anaphylaxis, your trauma patients, your septic patients, one of the biggest uses of end-tidal is just simply monitoring your cardiac output. And so obviously you're going to start to see a rise in your end-tidal when it comes to fluid resuscitation if you're using any type of vasopressors, norepi, dopamine, anything like that that you're using to get these people to a better state of cardiac output. One of the last things we wanted to kind of address tonight, because, I mean, this is such a lengthy topic that it easily could have gone on and on for hours with all the intricacies of it, but we wanted to spare you guys from having to listen to us that long, is the identification of the Chiari cleft in an already intubated patient. What is that? What does it indicate? And how do we need to address that?
So the Chiari cleft is basically the body's first indication that the diaphragm itself is starting to wake up. And this is for the patients who've been knocked down and given a paralytic of whatever nature to induce or to sustain the actual intubation process. And what you'll see on the actual waveform version of this is during the plateau stage, the end of expiratory phase, before the inspiratory phase, you have a flat line. And what you'll see is you'll have an inverted dip, generally towards the end of that, but it can be anywhere. But what you'll see is you'll see it in the same place on multiple waveforms in a row. It won't jump back and forth. But what that's indicating is the diaphragm is beginning to spasm, which means you only have a few minutes before the paralytic itself has completely worn off. So if you're working in a service that has paralytics, if you're fortunate enough to be in a service that's progressive that way, you're going to want to reparalyze these people chemically. Unfortunately, if you're working in a service that does not have the ability to use paralytics, these are the patients that you're going to want to make sure you keep a close eye on them. They're going to probably need additional sedation, whether you're choosing the Versed or the fentanyl route. if you have the ability via protocols to give something else, that's great as well. But these patients need a paralytic because they're only a few minutes from waking up. And to not cause additional patient harm, you have to understand and see this on the monitor and understand what you're seeing and realize that I have to fix this issue relatively quickly so that I can make sure this airway is maintained and kept in the condition that you got it.
Absolutely. I think we're going to go ahead and kind of call it quits for now. Don't be surprised if this is a recurring topic that we might add additional appendices to in the future. Just like I said, because it is such a broad topic, I just want to stop and say a quick thank you to Mr. Jason McConnell for allowing us to kind of pick his brain tonight. So thank you for that. If you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, gripes, moans, go ahead and check us out, cprpodcast.org. Leave it in the comment section, and we'll get back to you. Hope you guys have a great day.